We are now 8 episodes deep into the season, into this case, and into this story, and there have been a lot of details to absorb. Believe me, I know. Sometimes, though, we lose sight of the forest for the trees, so I thought it might be a good time to reset the stage so that we are all on the same page as we get even deeper into the nitty-gritty. Joanne and Alex Katranack were reported missing by Andy Katranack on December 15, 1994. Their bodies were found on April 9, 1995, about 30 minutes from their home in Catasauqua, Pennsylvania. By June 1995, the homicide investigation had turned its full attention towards Patricia Rohrer as their lead suspect, rather, as their only suspect. On November 8, 1995, a warrant was executed to collect Patty's hair and blood to be compared against hair evidence found in Joe's car and at the body site. On November 30th, an FBI memo was drafted noting that Patty's hair and blood had been delivered to the FBI lab and stating that, quote, presently there were no other viable suspects in this homicide and that Patty was, quote, armed and dangerous. Another memo dated nearly a year later, on October 16th, 1996, said the same thing in bold capital letters, armed and dangerous. That memo memorialized a conference between the Pennsylvania State Police officers, Pennsylvania State lab officials, the district attorney and assistant DA of Lehigh County, Pennsylvania, and the FBI and the FBI lab. All of these officials had gathered to decide whether or not it was time to pull the trigger and arrest Patty. They had been waiting patiently for the results of forensic testing before moving forward because they knew that this was not a clean-cut case. That Patty had solid defenses, alibis, and phone records that backed up her assertion that on the day that Alex and Joe went missing, she was in North Carolina. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed Towards Justice. This is The State versus Patricia Rohrer. I'm Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author. In today's episode, I'll be walking through those defenses with Tammy Mall, an author and longtime advocate of Patty's innocence, whose involvement in the case didn't start off with the intention that she would end up fighting for Patty's exoneration for over a decade. Hi, Tammy. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You know, this show probably would not have been happening if it weren't for you. You have been so deeply involved in this case. You have given it, I don't know how many years of your life, but I want you to please introduce yourself to our listeners. Tell us who you are and tell us what your connection to the Patricia Rohrer case is.
So my name is Tammy Mall. I'm a true crime author. And I got involved with the Rohrer Katranack case simply because I thought it would make a good book. Mm. Came into it believing completely in Patty Rohrer's guilt until I began corresponding with her. Then that led to phone calls and then visits. And honestly, she was the only one involved in the case who would talk to me.
Really?
Yes.
How did you even learn about the case? Did you see it on the media or how did it come to you?
So I'm from Pennsylvania, so I was aware of the case. It was pretty big news in this state when it happened. So I had always known about it, and it had always just been in the back of my mind because it was such a bizarre case, you know? The crazy girlfriend who drives 500 miles to kill the ex-boyfriend's new wife and baby. It just had every element of a really page-turning book, a good book.
Yeah. So you start just writing Patricia letters in prison.
I did. I wrote her a letter and she immediately answered it, again, maintained her innocence.
What year are we talking about?
So that would have been 2012. Okay. So I've been involved in this all this time.
Yeah. Okay. You say that you start learning things from Patty that you didn't know. because obviously what most people know about any kind of these stories is this is what we get in the media. And as our listeners know, even what makes it to court is usually not the whole story. There's a lot of stuff that doesn't make it in front of a jury. So can you tell us some of the things that like kind of surprised you and made you become an advocate for her?
Well, I mean, one of the things was one of the things that really piqued my interest was the fact that some of Joanne's friends had told the police that Joanne had found pictures of Patty that Andy had hidden in his bedroom closet. That bothered me because the whole thing was Andy didn't want anything to do with Patty. Patty was obsessed with Andy, you know? So I was very skeptical. And then she sent me the police reports. And it was like, oh my gosh, she's telling the truth. The contaminated evidence. She was convicted on contaminated evidence. I found that hard to believe. She sent me the lab reports showing it was true. Just, it was a lot of stuff like that, stuff you just never heard about,
And at that point, do you remember where she was kind of in her appeals process? She's had ongoing appeals all these years. Do you remember what was going on at the time?
She was pretty much done. When I first got in touch with her, she had filed a pro se brief on the Pennsylvania State Police tampering with the DNA evidence. And, if you know much about briefs, her brief was 165 pages long. She did it herself. And of course, it went nowhere, but she was pretty much out of options at that point.
And then you picked up the mantle, and ever since you've done so much work on the case and found new evidence to give it new life. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But I wanted to go over, I don't know if you're listening to the series or not, but if you are, we are at that point where the police are building their case against Patty. And there's a number of hurdles that they have to overcome in order to build this case and before they can make the arrest. Now, obviously, we are not covering this case unless she was arrested and convicted, and we believe she's wrongfully convicted. That's why we're all here. That's no surprise. So she does get eventually arrested. But I want to take our listeners to that point in time where the police have to contend with all this really favorable factors for Patty and how they're able to kind of not manipulate them, but I guess kind of like completely turn them against her in the weirdest way. So I want to start off with the phone records. Now, it feels like, you talked in the beginning right now about how you were surprised to hear that the narrative that Patty was obsessed with Andy wasn't exactly true. It was Andy, it seems, that were still interested in Patty and would connect with her as well. Now, that whole narrative stems from the fact that Andy, from the beginning, told the police, "This woman keeps calling my house. She's my ex-girlfriend. And so my wife had it." And you'd think it would be as simple as checking phone records because Patty is many states away. She's in North Carolina. If she made this phone call to Andy's wife, Joanne, the victim, it's going to appear on the phone record. So, and Andy says specifically that she called like 3 days before my wife disappears, right? Like that's what we hear over and over again. He says that Patricia called the house on the evening of December 12th, 1994, and his wife disappears 3 days later. And I'm again going to remind listeners that when Andy came home that night on the 15th and said, "Oh, my wife's not here," called the police. He called North Carolina that night. Like it was already, those wheels were in motion that like that Patty is involved somehow. Okay, so let's get to the records. We'll start off with Patty's records, and I've got, if you have the notes, I have them pulled up here. When Patty's asked about this, about calling the house, she tells the police, like every time she's questioned, "Yeah, I did. But I think it was like a week or 10 days before." She doesn't give them an exact date. She's like, "I think it was like a week before, maybe 10 days before," right? And so if you look into her phone records, and these are toll calls, this is back in the day, long distance calls. The only call made from her home to Pennsylvania, to Catasauqua, to their home, is made on December 7th at 7:32 p.m. It is 1 minute long, which lines up with what we know happened, which is that Joe was like, "Stop calling her," and hung up on her. So December 7th is 8 days before the disappearance. It was a Thursday when Joe disappeared, Joe and Alex, and this is the Wednesday prior. So then the police are like, "Well, maybe she called from her mom's house," and they pulled her mom's numbers, right? Once again, There's no calls in that week at all. The only calls made are the calls that her mom made when she's calling Andy back on the night that he called to ask where Patty was. So now you would think this would like kind of make the police stuck. What I find absolutely fascinating is how this was spun. And I have a screenshot of the 14th paragraph of the search warrant that was issued. This is the search warrant, I believe, that was issued before the probable cause warrant to collect her blood and hair. And so can you tell me like what's going on here, the way they're spinning this?
Well, I mean, if you look at Patty's phone records, you'll see that Andy's number is not the only number she called that day. She also called another Pennsylvania number. This was 2 days after she came back from her rodeo win.
Right.
And she was calling everybody. She was bragging about the win, which she had a right to brag about. It was an event that an amateur people who won the national title. This was a big deal.
Yeah.
They basically just believed Andy that she called on that day. And then the thing that really got me is in the prosecutor's closing argument, he said she was in Pennsylvania when she made the phone call, which I did talk to the prosecutor and he told me that same thing. I asked him, I said, where do you think Patty was when she made that phone call? And he told me she was definitely up here, which is not what he argued in trial. And I said to him, I said, then
can
why
you tell our listeners what he argued at trial?
He argued at trial that she made the phone call on December the 12th.
And then got in her car.
Yep. Then hopped in her car and drove 500 miles right after Joanne hung up on her. So when he told me she was definitely up here, number one, that's not what he argued in court. Number two, I said to him, I said, then why did she hide it? Mm-hmm. You said she hid it. She didn't tell anybody she was coming. If she was already up here, she could not know she was going to get into a fight with Joanne that would lead to murder. Why would she have hidden the... And he had no answer for me. None. None. Yeah.
It makes me just a little bit proud to say that whenever people come to my home, they always tell me how beautiful it is, how inviting it feels, how much they love how I've decorated it. And that is in no short part thanks to Wayfair. I cannot tell you how many beautiful pieces in my home I've ordered from Wayfair. I have been buying from Wayfair for years. Just about 6 months ago, I turned what was once an office space on my main floor into my own little cozy lady library den, if you will. Once I had my bookshelves and books in place, all I needed was a place to sit and read, and I found the most beautiful, huge, oversized beanbag chair from Wayfair that I fit into the corner. And can I tell you, when people come to my house, they're like, that, where did you get that from? If you have seen my social media, you know what I'm talking about. You have seen it on there. It is the star of that show, of that room. And now, as my middle child goes off to college, guess how she's furnishing her dorm room? Wayfair. Wayfair is your shortcut to the good stuff. They have a team of product specialists that vets everything. They use a 10-point inspection. They test things like the quality of the materials, the functionality and features of their furniture, and even how long it takes to build. And of course, they have so much more than furniture. They've got grills, appliances, storage, lighting, rugs, decor, everything, all in one place. Everything you need, no bouncing around between stores. And look, if putting stuff together sounds like a headache, they can even handle installation, along with delivery, of course, and assembly. You just pick what you want, what level of service you want, and they deal with the rest. There is a reason that Wayfair has over 20 million five-star reviews. It's because you're not buying blind. You can see real customers, real homes, real feedback before anything hits your cart. And that's my favorite thing to do. I love looking at the reviews. I love seeing people post pictures about how that particular piece looks in their home. Thanks to that, and thanks to the fact that they are so affordable, I am a Wayfair customer for life. Now look, if you are ready to upgrade your home for less, head to Wayfair.com right now to shop all things home and get your space ready for less. That's Wayfair.com, Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
A big problem with a lot of this story, and we've talked about this season, is like just the narrative, like, keeps falling apart. Like, it doesn't make sense. Even the fact that, for example, her car being brought back to the house, if somebody drove away with her in it, who brings it back? Right? It's like the
Exactly.
narrative keeps falling apart. And another thing I heard was that there was the possibility that maybe she made a phone call from a phone booth, or you know what I mean? Another way, and she was still in North Carolina. But again, it takes us back to this idea of why would she have done that unless she knew there was going to be a fight and then I'm going to kill somebody?
Exactly.
Right. Like
She
that.
had, she couldn't have known that was going to happen.
Right. And also,
So.
Andy reports one phone call. He says she called one time in December. There is one phone call. He never says that she called multiple times.
No,
Okay.
no.
Right. So if that's the case, then where's the other? Like, where, you know what I mean? Like, how do we. He would have to say that she called more than once. Simple as that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
I want to actually read this paragraph from the search warrant because I just think it's shocking, but it's also a lesson to me and to all of us over and over that like any set of facts can be spun in a way in front of a jury or like by authorities that you just can't even imagine. Here's what it says. The affiant, the detective who wrote this warrant, says that during this investigation, information was received from Piedmont Telephone Membership Corporation regarding telephone calls made from Patricia Rohr's residence during the month of December 1994. A review of her telephone records reflects that wild toll calls were made from her place consistently from the 5th of December to and including the 11th. No toll calls were recorded from the 12th to and including the 15th. Then toll calls resumed on the 16th of December and continued frequently. So what's basically he's saying is that from the 5th to the 11th of December, there are long distance calls. She's calling people, telling them I got back from Oklahoma, I did good. Then suddenly from the 11th to the 16th, there's no calls. 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 5 days, there's no long distance calls. And then on the 16th, there is a 9:40 a.m. call. Okay, so whatever Patty does, let's say she abducts Joanne and Alex on the 15th, right? And then kills them, leaves them, and drives back. She is back in her home by the 16th and making that 9:40 a.m. call. But the point being that instead of saying, well, there's no calls to the house the way the husband is saying, you know what I mean? Like what he's saying, what they're saying
Yes.
is we find it suspicious that there is a period of time in which there are no long distance calls. And that means to us that she must not have been around. Like that's how they're spinning it.
That's exactly how they spun it. Yes.
Yeah. It's wild. So, and then there is the fact that, Andy does call the mom that night. And the mom says, I just called Patty. She's in her bed. Like, why didn't Andy call Patty?
That is the big question. Because if Andy had called Patty, Andy would have become Patty's alibi.
Right.
And Patty, on the same hand, should have called Andy. She
She
should
should
have
have.
just called.
But the reason she didn't is because she says, is because she was told not to ever fucking call again. And
No, you're absolutely
yeah.
right. And she also says that she told her mother, let me call him. And her mother said, no, he told me, don't have her call. Because if Joanne comes in and I'm on the phone with her, she is going to freak.
Is that
So,
right? I did not know that part.
I mean, that, yes,
Okay.
that's what Patty says. That.
Okay. Okay. Because I
So.
haven't seen that in any of the statements, but it totally makes sense. And also, if Andy, you were that concerned that this absolutely nutty woman has come, like why wouldn't you call the house, right? But the other thing is, her mom would have had to know to lie. Her mom would have been like, well, Andy, I either
Yes.
she's in on it, right? So she's either faking an alibi for her daughter, and when she calls Patty, Patty's not actually there or whatever, and she's just faking the whole thing, but she has to be in on it basically, on this thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
Because
definitely.
otherwise, why would she lie? She'd just be like, well, she didn't answer, but it's 3 in the morning, Andy,
Yeah, yeah. And you are getting, if you get a call at 3 in the morning, maybe you're a little disoriented, not exactly like sure what's going on, and not making the best decisions at that point either.
Right.
But I'm sure in no way, shape, or form could Patty have imagined that middle of the night that I need to establish my alibi right now.
No,
I need to call him right now. She wouldn't have thought that. And folks have asked also about like, is there proof of the phone call between the mother and Patty to see like, did they actually somebody actually pick the phone? It was a local call. It's not reflected in the records. Mm-hmm. So that's the deal with the phone calls, and that's how the police dealt with them. The police looked at them and said, well, that's highly suspicious that there is a gap in the calls.
But they also did, the defense and the prosecution fought tooth and nail to keep that witness off. They hired a PI to go through the entire year of her phone bills.
Okay.
And there were several gaps.
Sure.
When there were no long distance calls. So it's not like, well, that was the only time ever.
Right.
That, you know, she went through. I mean, who makes a long distance call every single day of their life?
Yeah.
You know, I certainly don't.
I absolutely don't. I mean, like, and the other thing is, we're also talking about a time when long distance calls cost a lot of money.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I remember my parents being like, that's per minute, man. We're getting charged per minute.
Exactly.
From the landline. Yeah. Okay. So then we're going to move to, and these are, by the way, alibis that Patty offers to the police over and over again from the very first time she's questioned, which is on December 22nd, about a week after the disappearance. Again in April, she's interviewed. Again in May, she's interviewed. She consistently tells the police, these are the things I was doing. Now, the first time she's spoken to, she says, well, she starts with December 14th, the day before. She's asked, like, what were you doing in those days? She says that she bought gas at a gas station at this place called Haynes Gas Station. And then after that, she went to an Exxon to buy kerosene, and the pump wasn't working. So she goes inside and spoke to the woman at the counter who fixed the issue. Now, these are important details because when the police go back and they talk, that this woman actually remembers. She remembers this incident happening. Of course, they don't talk to her until many, many months later. She doesn't know the date. But the point being, back in December, Patty says, like, these are the couple of things that she mentions. I think she might also have mentioned cowboys on that first interview, but I can't quite remember that.
She did.
She did, yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about cowboys?
Yes. So Cowboys was a private club that Patty was a member of. And on Thursday nights, they held line dancing classes, which she had signed up for and went to on Thursdays. She typically was there Thursday, Friday, and Saturdays every week. So that's what Cowboys was.
Okay. And that was one of her alibis. And she's telling police this. But the thing about Cowboys is she says she was there on the 15th, because the 15th was a Thursday.
Yes.
So she says to the police, well, on the 14th, I got gas. I went to Exxon to buy kerosene. Those are the two things I remember I did on the 14th. On the 15th, she says, as she's telling them again, in all of these interviews, she's consistent. She says she realized that she lost the key to her van's gas cap. And she thought, oh, maybe I left it at the gas station, the Haynes gas station. She went back to ask them, did I leave my key here? And they're like, nope, there's no key here. Okay. Now, she has told the police this in December, but the police don't interview the person working at the gas station until July 25th, 1995.
Right.
And when they do, he says that, and this is, they interview a man named Michael Haynes. He says that Patty's a regular customer. She comes to the station a couple times a week for gas, but he doesn't remember if she came to the station, like when and if in December 1994. But he does remember her one time asking about some lost keys. One of the interesting things I thought that I saw in that, he also said he doesn't know when she asked for the keys, November, December, January, whatever. He says that it was a very cold day and it was before Christmas. Those are the two details he remembers. So, you know, I went back and I took a look at like the weeks before Christmas. That week, the week of the 15th was in fact the coldest week. It was even colder than the week subsequent to that. So, you know, I'm not saying that's for sure, but the point is that how do you establish? And this is something Patty brings up over and over again. Even when she's talking to Andy, she's like, why did they like not go and establish? I told them exactly what I was doing. All they had to do was interview them. She also says on the 15th that she went to buy some grain. So can you tell us about this?
So Patty had actually been accused of abusing her animals.
Mm-hmm.
Patty had a blind stallion who wouldn't eat well. I mean, he just wouldn't. I don't know. If you have ever had animals and you've ever had an older, sicker animal.
Sure.
A lot of times this is not, you're starving them. They just won't eat. But anyways, she was reported for this blind stallion, and animal cruelty officers came out and investigated. And they took her to court, and she was ordered to keep grain receipts to show how much food she was buying. So also on the 15th, she went to buy grain, and she bought grain from the Welcome Milling Company and a man named Leroy Rouse. and she went on the 15th, according to her. Mm-hmm. Now, when the police questioned Leroy Rouse, he told them that she usually came on Thursdays or Saturdays, mm-hmm. and that she had come the week before Christmas, which would have been the 15th, because the Thursday, the next Thursday was the 22nd, only mm-hmm. 3 days before Christmas. And I always kind of felt like he would have said, you know, yeah, she was there.
It was right a few before. Days before Christmas. Yeah.
Yes. But yeah. he said the week before Christmas. Yeah. So basically he was giving her an alibi as well.
Right. And that order that was issued for her to like make sure that she has the grain receipts and basically produce them on demand. So it wasn't like she had to check in every week, like it was a parole officer type of situation. Right. She just had to have the receipts in case they checked on her. That hearing happened on December 12th, which was the Monday of that week.
That's right.
And, right. So we know that happened. And by the way, which is another thing. Okay, let's say that hearing took place on Monday the 12th. She's at the hearing. Now, how is she going to be in Pennsylvania that same night making a phone call? Remember, I mean, think about that, right?
That's very true. Yes.
Right. Because now the prosecutor is saying, well, by that evening, because Andy's like she called on the 12th. That means by 7 or 8 p.m. that evening, she had to have been in Pennsylvania making that call from Pennsylvania, except she's in the hearing. And I can't remember the time, but I think the hearing was in the afternoon.
It was. It was around noon, I think, I believe.
And this is a 10-hour drive. So you're telling me she has this hearing and all of a sudden she's like, I'm driving to Pennsylvania to hurt somebody. Okay.
Three years after law school, I found myself living in a 300-square-foot studio apartment in Manhattan, trying to make ends meet. As a result, I've always been cost-conscious, with my mind then shifting to how to build toward retirement as I improve my financial position. But this financial focus was draining, at least before I found Monarch. Monarch has taken the mental load of tracking my money off my plate. Monarch helps set goals, map out big purchases, and see if you're actually on track before it's too late to adjust. It's different from other apps that only tell you what you've already spent. Plus, this is my favorite feature, you can split the check without the headache with Monarch's Bill Split. Just scan the receipt and everyone claims they got, then settles up, no separate app needed. Write your own money story with Monarch. Use code UNDISCLOSED at monarch.com to get your first year of Monarch Core half off at just $50. That's 50% off your first year at monarch.com with code UNDISCLOSED.
Again, the narrative doesn't work. So we know for 100% sure that she is in North Carolina on the 12th because she is at this hearing. She's ordered to produce these grain receipts starting that week. So she says the first, you know, that she bought it a few days later on the 15th, that she bought grain that day. Mm-hmm. And then as Leroy Rouse says, and we'll get to what happened to him later, like in terms of like him, why he actually never made it to trial. But again, she's telling the police that the police can go talk to him immediately, except that they don't talk to him until April of the following year. So she tells them in December, they don't go talk to him until April. And then again, they speak to him in July. But, you know, basically after the 12th, there's only two Thursdays between the 12th and Christmas. It's the 15th and the 22nd. It had to be one of those, right? And she says the 15th, and to a large extent, Leroy is backing her up. Then there's Tina Swenson. Can you talk about Tina, who she was?
Tina was Patty's next door neighbor. And on the 12th, I believe. Well, anyways, Tina would watch Patty's animals whenever she went away. That was a standard thing.
Yeah.
And I believe Tina saw her on the 15th, where Patty saw her and waved to her. She was getting her mail or something such as that around 4:30 in the afternoon. So Tina would mark down when she watched Patty's animals on a calendar, mm-hmm. which she subsequently gave to the Pennsylvania State Police.
Okay, so here's what Patty said. Again, Patty tells the police on the 22nd. A week after all this happens, she's like, I got home on the 15th. She's like, I bought my grain. Mm-hmm. And I saw my neighbor outside. Tina Swenson. And I waved to her. I told her I'm going to the club that night. And then I went to feed my horses. Now, I do want to talk about this because when I spoke to Patty, I asked about, you said she had a blind stallion. She didn't just have that one animal. She had a lot of animals.
She had a lot of animals.
Right.
She had, I believe she had close to a dozen, if not a dozen horses at that time.
Okay.
She had cats. Mm-hmm. She had a goat that she kept in her front yard. Mm-hmm. I think she had a dog. I mean, she had a lot of animals. It wasn't just a matter of put the horse out to pasture and he'll be fine for 3 days.
Right, right. So we're talking about if she goes away, that is like a dozen animals that need to be cared for, given food and water. And somebody needs to know that she's out of state doing stuff. But the thing is, then Patty also says that when she got that call in the middle of the night from her mom, the next morning she told Tina about it.
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, Patty said she couldn't go back to sleep after she got the call. She was waiting for somebody to call her back and update her.
Yeah.
And she said as soon as she saw Tina's lights come on, which I believe was at 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
It was early. She called Tina because she said Tina knew Andy, because Andy had come to North Carolina to see Patty on more than one occasion. So Tina had met Andy, and Patty said, I called her up just to say, you know, hey, look what's going on. You know, they're calling me. Joanne is missing. So, you know, she would have had to have been back by
5:30
in the morning.
That's the thing, though. So she tells the police this. Patty tells the police this is what happened. The police, once again, do not talk to her next door neighbor.
Nope.
Until July 25th of 1995. That is like 7 months later. And when they talk to her, Tina says to the police, I do remember one morning around 5:30 a.m. she called me and she was upset that her ex's wife and child were missing. And at that time, when she's spoken to by police that one time, she gives him a copy of the calendar because she's like, yeah, anytime Patty's out of town or traveling, like when she went to Oklahoma, I have to take care of the animals. And on the calendar, and we'll put it on her social media, there are little X's that she has marked for the days that she has to feed the horses or feed the animals. And they are marked for that month from December 1st to December 5th, which are the days that Patty was away in Oklahoma.
Right, right.
There is no other time in the entire month of December that she has marked down that she needs to feed the animals. Okay. How was this dealt with by the police? Probably, I don't know. Maybe they're like, because I'm trying to put myself in their shoes and they're like, well, what do we do with this, right? Maybe they're like, well, maybe she asked her mom to feed the animals while she went killing people. Maybe she let them go hungry because she's abusive, except that we have Fonda Eggers in the mix, and we'll get to her in a second, because Patty really couldn't afford to do that. She couldn't afford to have her animal abuse hearing and then abandon her animals for 3 days immediately after.
And the police totally ignored the other animals other than the horses.
Right.
They never talked about the other animals. So what they said was the horses were pastured. They were self-sufficient. They didn't need somebody to feed and water them for 3 days.
Right.
So they totally ignored the other animals that she had at her house.
Right. Right. Okay. So let's get to cowboys. And, you know, I mean, of all of these things, of all the alibis, I feel like the cowboys alibi should be like one of the strongest alibis, because it's not just that she says she went to this nightclub that night, but she tells the police, these are the people you need to talk to who know I was there. And so can we go through them? Let's start with Will or Pete Jarrett.
Pete Jarrett was the dance instructor. Mm-hmm. And Pete Jarrett initially gave Patty an alibi.
Yeah, his first interview.
He said, yes, she was there every Thursday in December.
Yeah.
So, you know, now Pete was a little bit, he had been in a car accident, and I guess his memory wasn't, you know, he had a little bit of problems.
He had a brain injury. He had a brain injury. Yeah.
Yes, he had a brain injury. Pete, they questioned continuously. Mm. I mean, they just kept coming back and coming back and coming back and coming back. And what I found really significant with him is they did get him to change his story, but they never got him to say she wasn't there. Right. At the end, all he started saying was, I can't say if she was there or she wasn't there.
Right.
And I thought that was telling, because they bombarded him.
Yeah, yeah. His statements change over time. And you can see them in the written statements as he goes from saying, She was there every single Thursday. I mean, like, unequivocally, he says she was there every Thursday in the entire month of December.
Yep.
Then he goes saying, I can't recall if she was, like, you know, what day she was there or not there. He does remember, however, and he says this in a subsequent statement, that because he had a table that was like his table, and, like, you know, this one crew would always sit there, and Patty was part of that crew. He said he remembers Patty sitting at a table sometime before Christmas. It looked like she was sad because some friend had died or something had happened to a friend. And Patty also specifically remembered that that particular week when she went, that Jarrett had given her tickets to the New Year's Eve party that was going to happen at Cowboys, and she was at that party. So once again, you've got, you know, a dance instructor. But then Patty says, but there's other people too. This woman named Lisa Evans was there. Brian Ward was there. Eric Harding. She names a bunch of people to the police. So let's go through them. Lisa was somebody who... She was not interviewed until over a year later.
Right.
Think right. about that. Patty's telling them in December 94, she's actually even, yeah, she's interviewed January of 96, which is more like 13 months later.
Yep.
Do you remember what Lisa said, or I can go through it?
Go through it.
Yeah. So Lisa says that, look, I don't, Patty was not a close personal friend. She's like, I joined Cowboys and in 94, in December, I was there every single weekend. I was there Thursday, Friday, Saturday. That was like kind of the thing. This whole group was there Thursday, Friday, Saturdays. And she doesn't remember, obviously, 13 months later, if Patty was there on December 15th, 1994. But she does remember Patty one night talking about a missing woman. And being sad. So that's what she's able to tell the police. And then the police also are aware of two other people that Patty tells them about. And she's like, talk to Brian Ward, talk to Eric Harding. And so can you tell us about Brian Ward?
So Brian Ward was Patty's boyfriend, became her fiance, also the father of her child.
Yeah.
They were just getting together in December of 94. But they were getting together, and they very much were together at the club whenever they could be. Brian claimed Patty was there on the 15th, that, you know, he was there, she was there, Eric Harding was there. The prosecution claimed Eric would lie because he was Brian's best friend. But the truth of the matter is, Eric and Brian had just met very shortly before this. Why would Eric lie about this when, you know? And another thing that when the police, and I'm sorry, because I'm going on to Eric rather than Brian.
That's fine. They're kind of a package deal because they say the exact same thing.
Yes. Yeah. And the one thing that when the police finally got around to interviewing Eric, Eric told them that he remembered that night because his brother had showed up at the club. And they had come and gotten him because if somebody came who wasn't a member, they had to have a sponsor. So Eric had to come out and sign for him.
And sign him in, yeah.
And he is signed in that night on the 15th.
Yeah.
On the sign-in sheets.
Yeah.
You know? Now, Patty isn't signed in.
That's the problem. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about these sign-in sheets. So Cowboys, you basically had to sign in when you came in if you're a member, right? Like, and if you have a guest, you sign their name, you know, they put their name down too.
Yes.
And on the 15th, Patty is not signed in. She is signed in on the 16th.
Yes.
She's not signed in on the 15th. And so that is something that obviously that is like, you know, the state presents this as hard evidence that she is not there.
Right.
Except that, can you talk about how these CS sign-in sheets work?
Yeah, it's not hard evidence because number one, dance class began before the club opened for business.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times when you arrive for dance class, the signing in sheets were not even out there.
They're for the club.
To sign in. Right. Now, were you supposed to leave dance class and sign in? That might have been a rule, but like Patty said, she said, who's going to stand in line when you're already in the club to sign in, you know?
Yeah.
And they were not heavily monitored. This was not something that they really stuck to. There were many, many people who claimed they didn't sign in a lot of times. They signed in with different names, you know, and a PI that was hired by the defense also went in, and he wasn't even known to them. He signed his name Richard Nixon once, I think. He, you know, so it was very lax. And the owner of the club testified to that. Yeah. He said, we try, but, you know, you can't. So that to me was not hard evidence. It wasn't proof she wasn't there.
Yeah.
Say big on your landscaping project now at Menards. We make it easy for you to enhance your outdoor living space with the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block ready to take home today. Build a fire pit or retaining wall with our tumbled Belgian wall blocks. On sale now. Save big on your landscaping project at Menards. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
Both Eric and Brian, they testified on the stand, and Brian, I believe, was never even interviewed by the police. I didn't find any police reports where he was actually interviewed, so they never even went to talk to the man she was with that night, meaning like in a romantic way. But both of them said the same thing, that there were times they would just kind of walk in, there were times they would like make up funny names, fictitious names, and write them down. They said this particularly if that person, that one person sitting at the front desk knew you, you were like a regular person, you know, they just didn't pay such a close attention to it. But it's, you know, it's just one of those things where I feel like if Patty had signed in, then the whole story, the state would have been like, yeah, but anybody can sign in. You can sign in
exactly.
For anybody. It would have, right. So I don't know how, to what extent that would have saved her. But Brian and Eric also remembered very specifically something happening that night, which is that she had an issue with her van.
Yes.
They were there at the club till the club closed, which is like 11 or 12 o'clock at night. They walk out to her van. And I thought these are really interesting details because Eric, who is a friend of Brian's, and they just recently became friends and he's just hanging out with the crew, says that Patty opens the door to her van. And by the way, the van, she has three cars. That's the car that the state says she took all the way to Pennsylvania.
Right.
That she opens the door to her van and she either turned it on or something, but there, like, the spark, there's like a spark that takes, like, happens, and then there's something wrong with the electrical, like the heat or something. And
the heat.
Right. Yeah. And so Brian was like, oh, I'm going to see if I can try to fix that. But Eric was like, I couldn't even get near the car because it smelled so bad because the back of it was full of horse grain.
Right. Right.
And again, that is the day that Patty says, I bought the grain and then I went to the club that night, the same night.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So,
and they both, you know, corroborate one another, right? But, you know, because of the sign sheet issue, when I read the trial testimony, you know, the state does a really masterful job of saying, how do you remember that that was that night? Like, you know, yeah, but it was your job to establish it was that night. Was it Patty's job to go and get statements from them? Like, what is she supposed to be doing?
Exactly. And I mean, Patty assumed they were going to check the alibis.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, Patty just assumed that it's like, I'm telling you where I was. You're going to go and you're going to check this out.
Yeah. And she would keep telling people, the FBI might contact you. The police might contact you, by the way. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
And why would she? So she mentioned cowboys on the very first interview, which was the 22nd. That's
right.
1 week after Joanne disappeared. Why would she give them these if these were lies?
Yeah.
Because she would have had to assume they are going to go and ask these people.
Right.
So, you know, that would be a big risk for her to lie, you know, and have them go and have the people say, oh, no, she was not at Cowboys or she was not here last Thursday. I mean, it just.
And the thing is this, I mean, at that point, if you think about it, right, it's a narrow window. The 22nd is also a Thursday. She's telling the police this. So whatever Thursday people are remembering, it's not that night because she's telling the police this in the morning. It's got to be one of the previous Thursdays, right? So it's
right.
the 15th or it's the one before that, the 7th, the 8th, after she gets back from Oklahoma. She's not even there the first week. Part of the issue here is that the police don't nail down these alibis. And as Patty is desperately trying to get people to keep this stuff fresh in their memories, she is totally like, I mean, the way it's presented at trial is absolutely awful. They present it as if she is fishing for alibis,
Oh,
asking
yes.
people to be an alibi rather than
Yep.
establishing her alibis.
Yep.
It was a no-win situation for her. And in fact, at one point, you talked about Jarrett, and Jarrett again was a dance instructor, and that he's the guy that police kept going back over and over and over again. Because here, look, if in the world of people who know Patty at the club, Jarrett's like the dance instructor. He has no personal vested interest in this, right? If he's like, no, I got she was here at my class, they're screwed. The police are screwed. At one point, and I don't know why he did this, but Patty calls him. She calls him one time. Well, this is what he says at trial. He says, the police kept coming back and talking to me over and over again. And at that point, I had started being like, I want to record these calls. At one point, Patty calls and he testifies she only called one time. And he records the call. Now, I don't have a, we don't have a, the recording, but we have the transcript. And in the recording, Patty says over and over, Jarrett, don't you remember that I told you about like my ex is missing, like the next, like, you know, the next day, which was the 16th, because she was signed in the 16th. The next day, I was sad. You saw that I was sad, and I told you what had happened. Like, don't you remember that? And his brain is scrambled. He's like, I remember that happening. I don't know when. And he's like, are you asking me to lie? She's like, no, I'm just asking you to not lie.
Well, yes, because what she specifically asks him in that recording is, can you remember any Thursday in December that I was not at dance class?
Other than when I was traveling.
And he says, as far as I can remember, no, I don't remember you missing any. And then when she says about, well, that's all you got to tell them, he says, they're asking for specific dates and I cannot give them that.
You're
You
right.
know?
And she keeps saying, I don't care about the dates. Just tell
Yeah,
them
you
that.
don't have to give them a date. Just tell them I didn't miss any dance classes other than when I was in Oklahoma. And, I think they very much intimidated him. I really do because on the, have you ever heard the recording?
I have not.
The recording is on, I believe, one of those shows. He sounds scared. I mean, he's like, they're demanding dates and Patty, I cannot give them that. So, I really think he was very afraid by the end to say to them, look, she was there. She didn't kill these people.
Because I can imagine in this situation, investigators saying to him, are you lying for her? Are you lying for her? Because, you know, we could charge you know, as an accessory. Like you, I mean, this is the kind of stuff we see over and over again. So anyhow, and Patty, by the way, also goes back to talk to others, like to talk to the guy at the Haynes gas station and talk to the woman who, you know, the Exxon pump wasn't working, being like, do you remember this? Just remember it because the police might come talk to you and I need you to keep remember this whole thing. So let's move on to Eggers. Now, this is one of the things that's incredibly, not just frustrating to me, it's enraging to me because it's so clear to me what happened here. Can you tell us who Fonda Eggers was, first of all?
So Fonda Eggers was actually a distant relative of Patty's, and she was one of the Humane Society officers. She was the one who basically, I think she's the one who reported that Patty was abusing the horses
Oh,
and got,
you think she reported it and then she started the investigation too? Because she was in charge of the investigation.
I think she's the one who came and said, yes, that, I mean, maybe she wasn't. Maybe she just was the one who investigated the abuse allegations on the horses. But Patty and Fonda had a history.
Yes, let's talk about that.
Fonda did not like Patty. Patty, before Fonda's husband got with Fonda, him and Patty were friends. And according to Patty, he was very attracted to her. And he would have liked to have dated her. And Fonda was jealous of Patty. So Fonda didn't like Patty.
Fonda had it out for
So,
Patty. Fonda had it out for Patty for sure.
yes. And in
Fonda,
fact, was admonished by the judge to stop harassing Patty. So he saw it too.
So Fonda, what happens is Fonda conducts this investigation. I don't know who brought the allegations, but they are like, well, I guess we got to investigate. She is an officer of the Humane Society. She's an investigator. She does this investigation. She brings these charges against Patty in two different counties. In one county, the charges are completely dropped. In the second county, that's when the hearing happens on the 12th, a few days before Joe and Alex disappear. And Eggers is there. Fonda Eggers is there. And that's when the judge says to her, you need to stop harassing Patty, basically. Back off, leave her alone. The judge does not take the animals away from Patty. He doesn't fine her. He doesn't jail her. He doesn't, yeah. He says, just buy the grain and keep the receipts. Okay, that's it. Now, here's the reason the Eggers thing makes me crazy is because when Eggers is interviewed by the police, and this is something, by the way, Patty didn't even know. Patty had no reason to know that Eggers was doing this, but Eggers had it out for Patty. Eggers said that her and a group of other neighbors, now we don't know who, it could just be Eggers herself, but she said, me and other people who lived around Patty were concerned that she was stealing horses. And we'll get back to that in a second. And so, what we decided to, a group of us, we conducted surveillance on Patty's house from December 12th to the 16th, very specifically. So, after the hearing to the 16th, she tells the police, we conducted surveillance at night 3 to 5 times in that week. Now, it's only 4 days she's talking about, right? So, nearly every single day, her or a member of her vigilante posse is conducting surveillance, okay? Now, this isn't a police report. This is not like Patty has no idea she's being surveyed, right? And what Eggers says is that, look, she tells the police, Patty's got three cars. She got a Dodge Van, she got a Chevy Blazer, and a Ford Thunderbird. And at some point, like every single time we were there, one of the cars was gone. So Patty was in and out constantly. She wasn't always home. She said that of the cars, and I think this is really important, she said we, but it was probably her, we wanted her out of the county. So one of the things we did was try to report the fact that her cars had expired tags and they were not insured and they were in bad shape. Like she's telling the police this, that even Patty's cars were in terrible shape. And we were hoping that would be a reason for Patty to just like, if she gets enough tickets, gets enough trouble, she'll just leave the county. But here's the thing. And I've told our listeners this many times, just because something is in a police report doesn't mean it's complete or accurate. The police, they will write down what they want to write down. They will write it down the way they want to write down, and then they will leave out what they don't want. The police report says that Egger says that I did not take notes specifically about the surveillance, like when I was there, what times I was there. But in 2002, a different investigator, and we'll talk about Margaret later, interviewed Eggers, and Eggers told her, I took very specific notes. I documented every single, because she's trying to build a case against Patty. So she's like, I took very specific notes and I turned them over to the police. We have never seen those notes.
No one has ever seen those notes. Not the defense, not Patty, no one. Those notes are gone.
Those notes are gone. I mean, you want to talk about an alibi? You know, those notes could say, I saw Patty, we saw Patty tottering around with her goat in the yard on the evening of the 15th. They could say anything.
Yes. And I believe they do say something because there's no other reason for
to
those
this
notes to have disappeared.
100%.
None.
Not. We have been trying to find a way to get those notes exist. What I'm trying to figure out is, and those notes are almost definitely Brady material. And our listeners know what Brady
Absolutely.
is. This is the kind of evidence that if we can find it, would get Patty a new trial. It would overturn her conviction and get her
I
a new
agree.
trial.
I agree.
So, you know, but Edgar says it wasn't just me. She's like, there are other people involved in the surveillance. She says she specifically gave the notes to Tony Roberson. Roberson, by the way, is the guy who wrote that search warrant. She, you know, as much as she hates Patty, in a way, she could have been the one to save Patty. But nobody knows about this. However, I don't know at what point this police report is disclosed. This isn't a police report. And if it was disclosed to the defense, it is a huge, huge oversight by Patty's defense that they did not latch on to this. What they should have done is put each one of those officers on the stand and made them testify as to what, where those notes went and what was in them. So Eggers, I think, could have been a very valuable witness in all of this, and those notes could be Brady evidence. But Eggers, by the way, did end up testifying at trial, but not about the thing that was important. Can you tell us what she testified about?
She testified about the animal abuse. She was brought on to make Patty look bad.
Yeah.
That's what the prosecution wanted her for, to make Patty look like an animal abuser.
And it is insane to me that the surveillance aspect of Eggers' involvement in this is never brought up by the defense. Because the defense could have easily been like, okay, this police report, by the way, here it is. It's in evidence. It's in front of everybody. It says that you surveyed her on the days that the state is saying she's in another state. Can you tell us what days, and like, you know, did you take notes? Did you, you know what I mean? Like, all those things could have been like completely unfolded on the stand and none of that was touched. And I think that was egregious.
Patty's lawyers were, I mean, I'm sorry, but they were terrible.
Okay.
They were terrible. They just did not go deep enough. They didn't ask the right questions. They didn't, you know, it was very sad. It was very sad, you know, because the lawyers were not, they did not handle the case well. And
yeah. I'm trying to, because if when I think about this specific, like when it comes to like the Cowboys stuff or the gas station, this and that, maybe, you know, the police are able, the state is able to raise enough doubt about these witnesses that, you know, the jury's like, they're not strong enough to overcome like the evidence that eventually convicts her. We're going to talk about that next week episode, but it would have been hard to overcome this if on the stand they had Eggers and they had, let's say, whoever else was a member of her little, you know, surveillance team say, no, she was there every single day. It was one question. All they had to do was there a single day that you did not see Patty? That's the only question they had to ask. Was there one single day that you did not see Patty?
Right, right. That's it.
Yeah. That's the Eggers alibi. And the police knew about it. Again, the police know about all of this as they are building their case against Patty, which makes me wonder, why are you building your case against Patty? Why? If those notes, like you said, and you're right, they only disappeared them because they could have helped Patty. Well, then why wouldn't you look at them and say, oh, well, then it couldn't be Patty?
I don't know. I don't know if they were just under so much pressure to solve this case. I really don't know why they went after her like they did. I just don't know. But one thing that I do know is, you know, it has been, what, 32 years since Joanne and Alex were killed? And Patty is the only person in this entire story whose story has not changed.
Right.
She's the only one in these 32 years. Prosecutor has changed his story. Some of the police officers have changed their stories. Andy has changed his stories. You know, she is the only one whose story has remained consistent.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know, I remember when I first spoke to you about this, you said, well, every time she would tell me something, then I would check it. It was true. Like there was never a time where you caught her in, you know, any kind of misrepresentation or nothing. Yeah.
No, I did. I have not. I still have not.
And she's maintained her innocence from the beginning. But here's the thing. I also think part of it is that, yeah, I don't know how they were able to so easily dismiss what Eggers had to say or those notes, because that would have been really hard to overcome. But I do think that they, if you look at like so many of the interviews that they took of people, they had built in their head this image that Patty was like this monstrous human being. She hated children. She hated animals. She was just a horrible person. She was a crappy mother. Yep. She would fight at bars. You know, she'd pulled knives on people. There's all this other stuff too, right? So yep. The narrative is that she's just not a good woman.
No, she's trash. That's the, you know, what I think the outlook was to them of Patty.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And Andy and her ex, Blalock, William, was like, oh, she's wild, even though he's like one of the worst people in the county.
Yeah.
One other thing I want to talk about is this, because I'm a little confused as to how to understand this, but I want to know what your take on it is. And that is the schedule from the tanning salon. There is a card and you know, Patty used to go to this tanning salon. I think it was called Sheer Happenings or something. So yes. I don't know if they did hair and tanning beds.
Yes.
And she had bought a package of 10 and you'd sign yourself in and out. And so we have a card from that week showing that she was signed in on both December 14th and 15th. Now, here's the thing. Number one, Patty never mentions this in any of her statements, I don't think. I've never seen her mention that she's at this thing, that she goes to get tanned on those days. Number two, we are pretty positive on the 14th, the salon was closed. The owner said the salon was closed. They had proof that they were out, like, in another state at the time. And then where it signed in on the 15th, it's hard to tell if it's the 15th or the 16th. But Patty never has, I've never seen her. Has she spoken to you about this?
Well, number one, Patty never tried to use that as an alibi. Police discovered it. And then they started coming out saying that, she forged these cards because she was going to use them as an alibi, but she got caught with that putting the date of the 14th on because the shop wasn't open. But Patty never used it as an alibi. Now, how Patty explained it to me was that this was a, the honor system. You came in, you wrote down the date, you wrote down how many minutes you tanned, and that often, people would come in, write a date, the owner would look at the card and say, hey, it's not the 12th, it's the 13th, or, and that's what happened with those, that, she wrote down the 14th, that she just wrote down the wrong dates. Is it true? I don't know if it's true. I will be honest with you. By this point, if Patty tried to fudge that card, I don't know as I could blame her. Because by that point, they were honing in on her hot and heavy, and they were twisting every single thing that was being said, Like you said, they didn't check her alibis. Now the people are saying they don't know, blah, blah, blah. I do know that the woman who owned Sheer Happenings said that she took all those cards out of there in early February. Now that was before Patty became a suspect. So if Patty was trying to, Patty had to know, oh boy, I got to come up with an alibi. So, she didn't have a big window to do that,
Well, I'll say this. I'll just be play devil's advocate, and that is that even on the 22nd, the first time the police spoke to Patty, they were asking for her whereabouts. And that should raise anybody's antennas. Like, why are you asking where I was? I'm in North Carolina. Even though most of the conversation was about Andy and, what he was like, they did say, by the way, where were you? So maybe she was like, wait, Andy also called to find out where I was. Maybe she's had enough interaction with the law that she's like, maybe I need to make sure that. But those are the kinds of the issues that the police are facing, and they are ignoring, and they're proceeding with their building their case against her, but they don't quite get there. In next week's episode, we're going to talk about how they kind of overcome whatever hesitancy they have, and that has to do with forensic evidence. But I want to talk about a couple more narrative aspects that I think are baffling, to me. And we've talked before about, like, how Patty would have had to know that the conversation was going to go sour with Joe, and then she's going to have to kill her, right? But either way, Patty also would have had to know if Patty did not leave the state, let's say on the 12th, let's say she left, I don't know, just in the nick of time, she would have to know that Joe is home. She would have to know Joe's movements. She'd have to know that phone line that Andy says that, whoever got his wife cut that phone line, because look, that phone line was not cut randomly, according to him. Him and the state are saying that this person tried to break into the house and cut the phone line. Okay. Like, this is all connected to their disappearance. So that person had to have a cordless screwdriver on them. They had to know they would need that tool to get in the back door.
Yep.
And then
A
they would have
pry bar,
a pry bar.
wire cutters,
Right.
cut the phone line.
Cut the phone line and know that the phone line was there, because here's the thing. The last time Patty had been in that home did not have a phone. Can you talk a little bit about, like, the whole phone issue too?
It didn't have a phone. Andy did not have a phone. And then later, Andy got a phone at his house, but he put it in Patty's name without her knowing. And this is where, the whole obsession thing comes in too, because Patty didn't know he had a phone. Andy had to be the one to call Patty and say, hey, I got a phone. Here's my new phone number, So it was not just Patty calling Andy and being obsessed with Andy. Andy was keeping in touch with Patty as well. And this was a couple times a year. It wasn't, like they called weekly, or this is a couple times a year, you know? Yeah. So I don't know.
Yeah. And Patty is seeing somebody. She's got a man. She's got a new man at the time all this goes down. But the fact that Andy is using Patty's credit, basically, her social security number, to set up this phone line that Patty has no idea exists in her name, because this man's credit is so bad that he doesn't have like bank accounts in his name. He doesn't have anything in his name.
No.
And so he has to use, and you know, I wonder, those phone bills are coming in Patty's name to Andy's house, and his wife is seeing that. Like, how is she, you know what I mean? What is she thinking about that?
How do you feel about this?
Yeah.
Now, when you put it all together, when you put, okay, you know, their phone's in her name. Andy has taken her calls before because Patty talked to Joanne.
She did once before. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, to Joanne, it's the phone's in his ex's name. He's still taking his ex's phone calls. And he's got pictures of his ex hidden in our bedroom closet. How did that make Joanne feel?
Yeah.
You know?
And Joan was not a wallflower. We've talked about.
No, she was not.
In this series that she would fight.
She was feisty from everything I've read about her and heard about her. She was very feisty. And
So imagine now Patty showing up in Joanne's face. I mean, you really think Joanne was going to get in the car and just drive? I mean, like, the narrative just keeps falling apart in so many ways.
Yes. Yes.
And that's what's so frustrating about this, that any reasonable, rational person is going to look at this and say, what is the state alleging here?
Yeah.
All right. So that's where we are, in terms of like the story and the case. And, we're going to pick up, next week by showing you guys how the state was able to kind of convince a jury that none of this stuff, none of this information, none of these alibis meant anything when it came to Patty being culpable of the murders. Tammy, thank you for all the work you've done. And I'm going to have you back on for another episode to talk about your role in the post-conviction work you've done. Because you have done, I mean, over a decade's worth of work investigating this case and looking for new evidence and putting your heart and soul and life into it. And it's not just Tammy, by the way. It's so many other people. And that's how and why this case eventually came to us. We're not the only ones who are like, the system got this wrong. A lot of people feel the same way.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for what you're doing, because I'm a firm believer in what she needs is publicity. People need to know this case. People need to get angry about this case.
Yeah.
You know, because it's just, it needs to be looked at again.
Yeah. 32 years later.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Tammy. We'll have you back on.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Tammy did, by the way, write a book about the case as she had originally set out to. It just wasn't the book she expected to write. Her book is called Convenient Suspect, and you can find it on Amazon in hard copy and e-version. One word of caution, though. Tammy changed most of the names of the people involved in the case, so it might be a little bit confusing because, well, here at Undisclosed, we name names exactly as they appear in case files. The October 16th, 1996 meeting that I mentioned earlier, the one where the authorities had gathered to decide if it was time to charge Patty, had been called because the forensic results the state had been waiting for had finally come in. Here is what the memo of that meeting said.
The primary purpose of this conference was to meet with Supervisory Special Agent with the FBI Laboratory DNA Unit. SSA presented an overview of the DNA examination conducted by himself relative to this investigation and which identified human hair recovered from the vehicle of Joanne Marie Katrinak. The supervisory special agent provided all present a description of the DNA process which exists only in the FBI laboratory. To date, the results of such DNA has only been presented at one criminal trial in the United States. District Attorney Robert Steinberg and Assistant District Attorney Michael McIntyre were provided suggestions by Special Agent relative to the presentation. Additional DNA analysis and blood-related analysis will be undertaken by FBI laboratory personnel relative to items submitted by the Pennsylvania State Police. D.A. Steinberg unequivocally stated that he would pursue Patricia Rohrer relative to the homicide deaths of captioned mother and infant son. Steinberg projected initiation of prosecution during January 1997.
next time on Undisclosed. As we all know, there is always more to the story. So tune in every Thursday during this entire season where we're going to be dropping our addendum episodes. In those episodes, we will go deeper on some of the issues raised in that week's episode, and we're going to answer listener questions. And if you want even more Undisclosed content, remember, you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you gotta do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at RabiaSquared2, the number 2. And you can follow Colin at EvidenceProf on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at Undisclosed Pod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate, Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.